Welcome to People in Wine.
Every time that I feel it bad, it always comes to my rescue. Every time that I feel tired, it always gives me something new.
We're beginning a new season of podcasts, and I thought we'd start with the subject of climate change and how this might affect winemaking in the future. So I put in a call to Professor Gregory Jones of the Department of Environmental Studies at Southern Oregon University, and first I asked him how he became to be involved with this branch of science.
When I was first starting to do my PhD, I was trying to find a topic to study. And I kept looking out there in the world of agriculture and even forest ecosystems, that kind of thing, trying to find where there was a good niche that somebody could be a good scientist and really make a difference. And I kept finding that there were quite a few viticulturists that knew a little bit about climate, but nobody knew a tremendous amount about it. Nobody was really punching the data and really helping understand it better. And I also saw that there were virtually no climatologists doing any real, you know, focused applied viticulture research. So it was somewhat of a natural, but there was also one other thing that happened right about that time. My father was a medical doctor, a dermatologist, and he was wanting to get out of the medical field and get into something he was interested in, which was growing grapes and making wine. So about the time that I was really delving into everything I was interested in, my father started doing his own thing. And I kept getting phone calls and you know, contact from my dad that he was asking me questions. Where does this variety grow best? What is the climate characteristics of this region that makes, you know, this wine style? And all of the questions he kept asking me were the questions that I couldn't find detailed answers to. You find general things. I mean, you can open up any wine book, and you can find things that, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon does best here, but nothing that really tells you why. As my dad was asking all these questions, and as I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, it just seemed like a no-brainer. There were tremendous numbers of things that could be done from a climate science standpoint, looking at viticulture and wine, and it would also help my dad and family.
Well, it's funny how destiny lends a hand in these matters. Perhaps you could just explain what the real issues surrounding climate change are. Is it a question of the world heating up, or is it about ocean levels, soil erosion, pest control, abnormal weather? I mean, is there any one thing which would push us over the edge?
Well, I think you've covered the breadth of most of what I think is the issue. It's a real holistic kind of thing. I don't think that any one region has any one thing that's most important. If we look at climate, we know that climate is, you know, a lot of people tend to say, well, we talk about temperature and rainfall, but there's so many things tied into the extremes in temperature and rainfall and how that influences what we do. And then those extremes in turn influence the vine and the crop, but they also influence the soils, influence the water quality or water availability. And so I think you probably encapsulated it, that there's a whole suite of issues that are very, very important. However, if you do go to some regions, you can say, well, these two are more important than anything. For example, we go to Australia. The issues in Australia for the past 10, 12 years have been drought. I mean, pretty extreme drought. And so if you look at that continent, number one, it never had much water to begin with, if you go back as far as we know. That many people on it, and then the size agricultural acreage, there's a real challenge and demand for water there. So a prolonged drought, which in our lifetimes, 12 years is a long time, but in reality that's just a drop in the bucket Australia potentially could, you know, 100, 150, 200 years of this kind of drought. And in any case, then a climate change that we've been seeing potentially could put Australia in a very negative light in terms of being able to do what they do currently.
Well, nearer to home, California, desert state pretty much. Even the governor was talking recently about water management problems. And this is related to climate change?
California, like Australia, is past its carrying capacity in terms of water. I think that there are some significant issues on the horizon. The California's potential to continually grow grapes and make wine will be more impacted by the availability of water than it probably will be by climate change. However, climate change will exacerbate the availability of water. So there's some definite ways to that, but you're so right that water are going to be very prominent.
In terms of developing rootstocks and clones which might withstand changes in climate or water fluctuations, is this a question of adapting plants for their taste, or is it far more reaching where in fact we're looking at the disappearance of certain varieties which can simply no longer withstand the climatic conditions where they've grown for hundreds of years?
Well, I think there's again a range of responses here. If we go back just to the varieties in general, grapes are a little bit unique relative to, you know, other type of specialty crops. I mean, you think of something like a pineapple. You know, there are different varieties of pineapples, but they all tend to grow virtually in the same place. There's no dramatic climatic differences for pineapples. But you go to something like a grape, and we have a wide range of varieties that grow in climate conditions versus warm to hot climate conditions. And so with grape varieties, most of it really depends upon the climate structure of the region. If you're at the very low end of the spectrum and you're growing cool climate varieties today, warms, then you have a much wider range of varieties to shift to maximize your new climate, if that makes sense. But if you put yourself to the upper end of the spectrum and you're already a fairly warm place and you're producing good wine, but yet you know it's climatically not ideal and it warms by a few degrees, then that pushes you outside your threshold. And it makes it much more challenging.
I'm taking the example of Champagne.
See, if you really put the perspective on Champagne, what it comes down to is that if they warm by a couple of more degrees in the next 50 years, they're committed to doing still dry wines than they are doing sparklings. And so the question is that do they continually do what they're doing today in maybe a different way and a different style, or do they really go to doing what the climate allows them to do? And so there's a real perspective on that. You know, Burgundy is the same way. Burgundy is the kind of the ancestral home for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. You know, it's considered to be, you know, by many people the sweet spot, so to speak, of those varieties. But if it warms beyond what's suitable for them, all you got to do is drive down the road or go down the train track toward the Rhone, and Syrah is the next variety, or I should say maybe Gamay Beaujolais and then Syrah. So You have to have some kind of a varietal shift that potentially can come about. But, you know, the other thing that you did mention is the idea that varieties, there are clones, different rootstocks, and then there's a whole area that hasn't been fully realized yet, and that's all genetics. You know, we tend to do plant breeding in grapevines that help us produce clonal selections that are hardy in some ways. Maybe they're less susceptible to certain types of diseases, or maybe they do better in, for example, in Australia, where the soils are pretty dry and have a lot of salts in them. There's been breeding there to deal with salt tolerance.
Can a winemaker do anything, or does he have to sit back and watch his world change?
Well, I think that there are, you know, definitely in the vineyard, there's plenty of things that are adaptive processes that can happen on the short term. Number one, looking at different varieties. Number two, looking at clonal differences among varieties. And then really combining that with the rootstock that works best within the soil and water environment that is expected. and then how people train their vines. And our ultra management may have produced really good quality in some varieties in some places, but it also may have overshot the issue. And that if we go back to a little bit more of letting the vine carry a little more fruit or a little more vegetation, maybe that can be an adaptive measure that people can do. Now, what can winemakers do? Well, I mean, there's a lot of it already going on today. If you look at the trend toward harvesting ultra-ripe fruit produces sometimes the flavor and the phenolics and everything you want, but it surely doesn't produce the acid structure, and potentially it has too much alcohol. And so for a winemaker, the optimum thing there would be to acidulate and remove alcohol. And so those two processes are an adaptive measure that winemakers do. Now, we know that in a cool climate, when the fruit doesn't ripen completely, people do the opposite. They add more sugar so that they can balance the acid sugar and then ferment it to an alcohol level that is optimum for that wine. So, yes, there are things that can happen in the winery, and there may be even some more kind of very molecular kind of things that will come out in over the next few years. The idea that we know that yeast strains can ferment and produce flavors and alcohols that are different. And so you can do selective yeast use. You can also do a certain, type of maceration versus another. You know, there's a lot of little processes that can be done to do adaptive measures on the short term.
Well, this goes slightly against the grain, doesn't it, where producers claim that terroir is 90% of the wine they make.
It's really getting at the heart of the question that you just asked, was that what does the future mean for any industry, really, in grape growing? But a lot of the old world French, and even other parts of Europe, but the French are still more steadfast than others, is that how do we move forward in looking at what they view as the difference between terroir, driven styles and wine processing versus industrial processing, in the New World. And, the issue it really comes down to is that freedom to produce what your land and your climate will give you is part of what the New World's all about. The French concept and even, the European concept historically in the Old World has always been about preserving regional identities through the process of recognizing them, like, Roquefort cheese or Parma sausage or, whatever it may be. Those kinds of things are very prominent, and I fully believe that that's important. But if the government and or the wine regions don't allow the growers to adapt, then the growers will be left with an antiquated and maybe unsuitable product. If they need to change, they've got to have that ability. I fully believe in the French concept of terroir as it stands. I think it's a very important piece. If you look at it, they really touted the whole issue of Burgundy is Burgundy for a lot of different reasons, but it's also about comparative advantage. I mean, if you look at it, Burgundy grows Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Nowhere else in the entire country are they allowed to grow and produce Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and have it be labeled as such, except during Champagne when they make sparkling. And so that's a comparative advantage. Don't you know that there are other places in France that can grow Pinot Noir and Chardonnay? Of course there are. It's the same thing in my state. If my state of Oregon decided to use the French model, then we would develop this historical perspective that you can only do this here and you can't do it anywhere else. And that would be good in some cases, but it would subject the individual grower and producer to being static and stuck in the system. I just don't think that that's necessarily the healthiest economically and culturally.
I was wondering, given that models are probably no more than 50% accurate at best, things might get worse faster or they might stabilize. I mean, you wouldn't run the rest of your life on the basis of a flip of a coin, would you?
What happens if every other summer was like the summer of 2003 in Europe, where it was extremely hot? Well, that's kind of the what most climate models are projecting for the conditions to be by the middle of this century. And so, again, I think you're right. The idea of kind of how we use this information to kind of move forward. Part of the human, I don't want to say it's a problem, but part of the human issue here is that we are mostly about immediate gratification. The vast majority of society operates on immediate gratification. How can I feed my family today? How can I pay my bills this year? How can I provide for my retirement in 10 years? You know, those kinds of things. Those are all pretty much immediate gratification issues. And the problem with climate change is that it really is an immediate, urgent kind of thing. And so I kind of liken it to the difference between, you know, someone coming running at you with a butcher knife trying to kill you versus scientists telling you that, you know, in 20 years we're going to have a meteor hit the Earth and it'll kill you. Mm. I mean, what are you going to react to? Mm. You're going to react to the guy coming at you with a knife. And so naturally our entire world operates on these immediate issues. And therefore when we look at something that's a little bit fuzzy and a little bit unknown, a little bit uncertain, and it's a little bit out there, then we don't tend to react to it the same way. Now, I think that the wine industry in and of itself probably has more latitude for time, so to speak, or adaptive processes over time. I think that a place like Champagne or a place like Burgundy or a place like the Napa Valley or anywhere like that will have to make changes immediately. What you have to do is you have to be aware. You have to be working within a system that allows you to adapt to what the conditions give you in terms of production. If I own a vineyard in Napa, and I all of a sudden see that, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in a row, I'm really not doing very well with this given variety, I'm going to change. But if you're in Bergen and you see the same thing, can't change. So the idea is that I think that there's definitely time and processes that will allow the industry to adapt, but it has to be allowed to adapt. And if we're looking at climates, let's say we're only looking at climates half as different as what we're projecting them to be, that's still an issue.
My thanks to Professor Jones at the Department of Environmental Studies at Southern Oregon University. The music is by Thirst, and the podcast is written and presented by Fabian Cobb. An article on climate change and other subjects can be found on our website at finewinejournal.com. Goodbye. And a poem and a holy chain that was said by a